Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Tuesday, March 31st, 2026. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. New version of bill requiring all Idaho police departments to apply to help ICE advances. Boise City Hall takes down Pride flag after Governor Little signs censorship law. And Idahoans for Women need some more signatures by the end of April to get the return of reproductive health care rights on the ballot for this November. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The bill that would require all local law enforcement agencies in Idaho to apply to enter into agreements with ICE has come back after the Senate State Affairs Committee killed it March 15th due to opposition from the state's county sheriffs and city police chiefs associations. That same committee yesterday sent an amended version of House Bill 659 to the Senate floor with an amendment. The bill would require all city and county law enforcement agencies to apply for the federal 287G program. Republican Senator Kelly Anthon of Rupert sponsored the amended bill with the addition of language saying participation with the federal ICE program will only be required of police departments, quote, to the extent that the necessary resources for participation are reasonably available to the law enforcement agency.
That was the intention, to make sure that cooperation with ICE and communication with ICE is governed by agreements that are set forth by the federal government, these 287G agreements, and that we don't see that cooperation differing from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, that we create the general rule with the exceptions. And when I say exceptions, what I mean by that is that with this drafting, the bill was meant to be both kind of firm and practical. So it does require agencies to apply and participate to the extent resources are reasonably available. And it allows county commissions or city councils who are in charge of budgets and other duties that, particularly the county commission that the state puts upon them, that if they feel like the program isn't working, that they would be able to make some specific written findings about the participation and move forward without it. So again, meant to provide a standard, meant to provide a general rule that cooperation with ICE is something we expect from our local jurisdictions, and to provide, you know, reasonable accommodations if for certain jurisdictions it just doesn't work.
That was Republican Senator Kelly Anthon of Rupert. Under the new version of the law, county commissioners or city councils would have to issue a finding of fact stating why entering into an agreement with ICE, which is known for its violence and disregard for due process, would hinder their local law enforcement agency. Republican Representative Dale Hawkins of Ferndale sponsored the original bill that the Senate committee killed last month. Law enforcement officials who testified against Hawkins' first version of the bill expressed the same concerns in committee yesterday. Here's some of that testimony, starting with Canyon County Sheriff Kieran Donahue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I represent the Idaho Sheriff Association. I'm Kieran Donahue, Sheriff of Canyon County. Just to Mike's quick, the tort claim for the federal side, the 1983 Act claims, even when people are tasked out to the federal government, like on a 287G task force, or if they assist the federal government, like in my case recently in October, I'm sued under federal tort law individually, as myself individually, so I'm not covered at all. So just keep that in mind. And my officers are also being sued. This bill that has been resurrected in the last few days has us participating in the 287G unless we can affirmatively justify why we can't do that. Rather than allowing decisions to be based on us as local sheriffs and chiefs and our operating procedures voluntarily like it has been, Board of County Commissioners are going to speak for us. I am not under the purview of the Board of County Commissioners. I'm a constitutional officer. I can't speak for the chiefs of police, and of course they're not here to speak for themselves. But I'm not under their purview. So why would I defer to the Board of County Commissioners to speak on what my operation is? Third, the federal government is in local decision-making. I think that moves away from local control for the state of Idaho. We have the federal government overseeing us. This reframing of this bill doesn't change the bill. We are already voluntarily working with federal government, with ICE throughout this state, and have been for many, many, many years. It doesn't eliminate the mandate. And also in Section 2, you have an internal inconsistency. Section 2 states that participation is required only when resources are reasonably available. However, Section 4 requires agencies to justify non-participation to the federal government. So if you're going to go to the amending order, there's more things that have to be done in this bill to accommodate local law enforcement. I know my time is up, Mr. Chair, so I'll stand for any questions.
Senator Shippey, let's go with you first, and then we'll...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Sheriff Donahue. Thank you for being here. I wanted to maybe just follow up a little bit on subsection 3. It says, upon a specific written finding fact by the county commissioners for a county sheriff. And you touched on that a little bit. I wondered if maybe you could just explain that a little bit more. I think some of the misconception out there is that the sheriff works for the county commission, and obviously that's not the case. And I wondered if maybe you could just talk about that a little bit and what you see specifically in this legislation that would either kind of misinterpret that reality or kind of erode the separation of powers there as you see it. Maybe you could just talk a little more fully about that.
Sheriff Donahue.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Shippey, you're absolutely right. There is a misconception, I'm not saying by the sponsors of this bill, but in the general public, that the sheriff works for the Board of County Commissioners and other constitutional officers as well. That simply couldn't be further from the truth. We do not. We are all constitutional officers. We have our express powers, our implied powers, our executive powers. We have our own purview. So I think where the confusion lies in this particular instance, as you framed it, is that if the sheriff and his operating procedures from the jail perspective or a manpower perspective, and we can break that into 287G and the jail model, which we've discussed last time we were here, and the 287G task force model. The sheriff and his staff completely know what the operational fundamentals are every day, what the resources are, what the needs are. And that's in complete contrast to Board of County Commissioners. Yes, the Board of County Commissioners are the fiduciary for the county. They authorize our budget based on what we present as our needs in our budget. But things can change day in and day out, every day, 365 days a year. So it would be a misnomer for people, the general public, to believe that the commissioners know what kind of operational pitfalls and restraints that I'm going to have in operating under 287G or sending manpower to be trained by 287G authorities in the state of Georgia or wherever they are sent to. And furthermore, the memorandum of agreement that we would have to sign into, and I believe we spoke about this before, with ICE to enter into that 287G, that's the unfunded mandate part of this, because there's still a cost to the sheriff. Now, I don't go down to the Board of County Commissioners every day and brief them on what we're doing. That just doesn't exist. I don't have a need to, because once my budget's authorized, I operate my budget. And so there are many, many idiosyncrasies that are just not known to the Board of County Commissioners. So to have them as written, that they would be able to find out if we could participate or not, again, is misleading, I guess, to be polite.
And I'd follow up with that in that 25 years ago, back in 2001, I was a freshman county commissioner in Bannock. And I made the mistake of treading into waters that I had no business treading into, and learned real quick that the county commission controls the budget. And once that's done, that's really the extent of that power, if you will, over whether it be the sheriff, clerk, or so on. So I believe you're absolutely correct that they don't have control of your operation, only the budget by which they fund it. Senator Ruckte.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sheriff Donahue, This is my concern with the bill, and I want to know if you share it, and if so, can you explain why? So I don't have a problem if our sheriff's departments, other law enforcement, work with ICE. I just don't want them working for ICE. And I don't have a problem with them working with the federal government, but I don't want them working for the federal government. Does this bill, in your reading of it, require sheriff's office, law enforcement, to work for ICE or with ICE?
Sheriff Donahue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Senator Rucki. That is a very, very good framing of analogy of what I personally see in this bill. I think I share that with many other sheriffs. As I've stated many times, we voluntarily work with ICE. We have a very great relationship with ICE. If this bill were to say no sheriffs and no law enforcement officer in the state of Ohio can ever not work with them, well, that's a whole different story. That's not what this bill says. It says that, in essence, we shall, through different aspects, work with them and be a 287G facility and under 287G unless there's these extenuating circumstances that we have to justify to the federal government that we cannot. That's a big change. And the good senator has mentioned that he's reached out to his federal partners to look at this bill. And I believe he framed it that to make sure it's good policy for Idaho. I would contend that. I would say that's not correct approach, because we should know what's good policy for Idaho. You're looking at the people who know what's good policy in a sheriff's office for Idaho. We do this every day. And so there is a danger, in my opinion, and I've spoken to this publicly and I believe in this committee, that there is a trend to lean on the federal government. They're going to tell me that I'm working for them. And I think I said it before, that a bill such as this implies that we are going to work with/for the federal government. And I think that is a completely the wrong approach to anyone in law enforcement, especially when we look at, there are things that I agree with what ICE does, but there are also things I disagree with what ICE does. I can be supportive of the administration and still disagree with that administration. And that has reared its ugly head, right? And recently included. So I think there's a real danger for the state of Idaho. And this, I'm not saying this is a blame to any of the sponsors of the bill, but we have to be very, very careful that we're not leaning in and opening up that tent to put that camel's nose under that. The federal government is going to be leaning in trying to tell us what we shall do or what we must do, along with what their mission, their perceived mission is. I think that's very dangerous.
I don't see any other questions. Thank you, Sheriff, for being in committee.
Thank you, Mr.
Sheriff.
Chair,
Matt Clifford. Welcome to the committee. Your name and who you represent.
Thank you, Chairman. Matt Clifford, Ada County Sheriff, is here for the Idaho Sheriff's Association. Answered Senator Ruckty's question. I think you look at line 34 on page 1. It has the words federal oversight in right there by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So that's pretty simple. Which is one of the reasons I don't like this bill. But I'll tell you a quick story that is a good example of why this is bad legislation. We work with the U.S. Marshals a lot, and we're on a U.S. Marshal Task Force, and we're on a lot of federal task forces. About 3 years ago, 4 years ago maybe, the U.S. Marshals, under the Biden administration, no offense to any Democrats in the room, under the Biden administration, the DOJ came out and said, you want to work with us? You got to sign this MOU. So basically, your kind of contract-ish document that says, if you get involved in a critical incident, all the evidence belongs to the federal government. Your body cams, your reports, everything belongs to the federal government. So we have no ability to do an investigation if our people get in a shooting with the U.S. Marshals. Now, a sheriff in Idaho looks at that and says, I don't think so. And that's exactly what I did. And I said, I'm not signing that. We no longer work with the U.S. Marshals. And then 2 years later, they came back and said, we really want to be partners with you. We fixed it. And I signed the MOU, and we work with them today in conjunction with ICE. This takes that away. There are backdoors written into here for inabilities, not for this is not good for the community anymore. What happens when Kamala Harris gets elected here in 2 years? everybody in here is going to be crying because now we have to comply by this law, and I don't have an inability to be to work with the 287G program. It can change from administration to administration, just like the DOJ changed its rules when it got a new administration. And we came back, and they came back and said, hey, we fixed this. Will you work with us? I recognize that it's good for Idaho then, and we can work with them again. And we have a great relationship. Same with ICE. The ironic part of this is probably by the end of the year, you'll see me have portions of 287G. That's the irony of it. But I don't like being tethered to them and saying, yeah, you don't have to if you can't. That's the answer for questions.
I still would like to put a little finer point on when that happens and ICE comes in and they're using some of your officers. Do they pay their wages? Do they pay for the replacement people you have to fill the shifts that no longer are being filled? Can you put a little color to that for me? Because I'm still not nailed down on how that all works as far as who's paying and that type of thing.
So there are some monies that can come into you. Usually when we're on a task force, what it involves is they'll pay overtime for the person on the task force or people on the task force, and they'll pay for a vehicle. So there is some monetary, quote-unquote, value to that, but we've pulled people off task forces that we've wanted to be on because we can't staff them as well. So there's not a monetary enough task force that I can say, well, we don't need to worry about having that person here on a normal patrol or something like that. So there are some things that are covered, but it's not going to cover everything.
So when they're in the employer working with ICE, let's say, is there a report to the commander of the ICE unit, or is it still to the sheriff, or are they immune from the supervision of their sheriff for that time, or how does that work?
Chairman, so, well, if this is under the oversight of the federal government, then we lose some decision-making ability, because under this, unless I show an inability to have my deputies do that job, I don't want them to do that job, then yes, they're going to be under the purview of ICE. It says right in their federal oversight.
That was Ada County Sheriff Matt Clifford. During testimony on the original bill, the committee chair cut off testimony from a constituent who started to speak about the harm that ICE does to communities. The Senate State Affairs Committee sent the revised bill from Senator Anthon to the Senate floor on a 6-3 vote yesterday with an amendment order. Anthon said he wants new language to clarify when the Federal Tort Claim Act applies to allow private parties to sue the U.S. government. Also Monday, the Senate State Affairs Committee rejected a bill that would allow the state to release incarcerated people to ICE before their sentences were finished. Republican Senator Lori Den Hartog sponsored that new legislation that would allow the Idaho Department of Correction Director to reach agreements with ICE to move an offender to an ICE facility before their jail or prison term ended, with the exception of people serving life sentences. Under Den Hartog's bill, if ICE deported the person, the Department of Correction could seek to have the offender extradited to Idaho if they returned to the U.S. Den Hartog said her bill would save state taxpayers $3.6 million in prison costs. The committee voted 5-4 to reject her bill. Idaho Governor Brad Little signed a censorship bill today that bans local governments from flying the Pride flag on municipal property. The city of Boise took down the Pride flag in front of City Hall today. House Bill 651 went into effect immediately upon the governor's signature because it had an emergency clause, which means those who voted for the bill felt it was an emergency that local governments were expressing support for the LGBTQ community. Gay and trans community members have been continually under attack by state leaders and others since the far-right Christian nationalist movement has effectively dominated the state legislature. According to the Idaho Press, Boise Mayor Lauren McClain said, "This law seeks to erase both the values we hold dear and people who are integral to the fabric of our community. We will continue to celebrate the vibrancy of our community, the diversity of our residents, and our North Star of being a safe and welcoming city for everyone. McLean said the $2,000 per day fine under the bill was the reason for her decision to order the city workers to take down the pride flag today. Republican Representative Ted Hill of Eagle wrote the bill, which lists the flags that local governments can fly in Idaho. Those include official flags of military branches and units, the POW/MIA flag, the official flag of recognized Indian tribes, and the official flags of countries other than the United States for special occasions, with the exceptions for nations the U.S. is engaged in hostile action against. The version of the bill the Idaho legislature passed last year had no enforcement provision, which is something Representative Hill's bill this year does have. The new bill gives local governments 10 days to correct a violation before the Attorney General can take civil action against the municipal government. Boise also got around last year's law when the City Council voted to make the Pride flag an official flag of the city. Hill's new bill prevents that workaround because it only allows the official flags of the city after 2023. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report.
Those who don't conform to society's traditional gender norms often face social exclusion and discrimination. But today's Transgender Day of Visibility aims to reverse those negatives and instead celebrate the lives and contributions of trans people. Created in 2010, the day is set aside to put the focus on narratives of empowerment over erasure. Mateo Nevels with the Lavender Rights Project says transgender individuals have been pushed to society's margins, but like all others, deserve to be treated with respect, dignity, and equal rights. He hopes one day a majority of people will move past their intolerance.
Actually seeing that we are people who work, people who have families, people who have kids, people who are artists and organizers and faith leaders and all the things that a human being can be, that trans folks are also that as well.
Under federal law, it's illegal for health providers, insurance companies, and other health programs to discriminate against transgender people. The same is true for employment, housing, and education providers. But legal protections vary by state, and there's a national movement in the U.S. aimed at restricting transgender rights. According to the Trans Legislation Tracker website, 747 bills have been introduced in 42 states this year to block trans people from receiving basic health care, education, legal recognition, and the right to publicly exist. The psychology of othering or scapegoating certain groups of people is widespread in nearly all societies. Neville says trans folks are just the latest target, based on fear of the unknown, personal bias, critical media coverage, or perceived threats. He notes it often leads to dehumanization and even violence.
Trans people are the scapegoat currently, but somebody else will be the scapegoat tomorrow or in a week or in a year. And something that we've been working really hard to do at Lavender Rights Project is to talk to people about our shared humanity, our shared goal.
Argentina, Canada, Malta, Portugal, Spain, and Sweden consistently rank the highest in terms of support for transgender rights. The United States and Brazil are frequently cited as having the highest total numbers of transgender people living within their borders. I'm Roz Brown, Washington News Service.
KRFP programming is sponsored by listeners like you and by Essential Art Gallery and Fine Gifts at 203 South Main Street in Moscow, showcasing high-quality art, pottery, jewelry, art glass, sculptures, scarves, textiles, wood and metal art, and fine chocolate and gifts from regional, national, and international artists. KRFP is also sponsored by Moscow Ale House, with something for everyone in the family. You can find Moscow Ale House at 226 West 6th Street or call 208-882-BREW. That's 208-882-2739.
As the impacts of increased ICE activity and cuts to SNAP benefits for refugees and asylum seekers continue to ripple across Oregon, organizations serving these populations are working to meet their growing needs. About 3,000 refugees and asylees in Oregon have lost their SNAP benefits since changes from H.R. 1 took effect early this year. Abdul Hassan is with Community Empowerment Foundation, or CEF, a nonprofit that primarily works with Afghan immigrants and refugees, most of whom came to Oregon legally and have active asylum cases. Hassan says many Afghan immigrants face language barriers and can't find living wage jobs.
They mostly rely on SNAP benefits, and the current changes have put the people in a situation that I would say they don't have enough food on the table even for their family members.
He says CEF used to expect about 30 families at its food distribution events, and now they expect at least double that. He adds the restrictions on SNAP have led to new collaborations across organizations supporting migrants. CEF is working with Oregon Food Bank, the Pacific Refugee Support Group, and others to meet the growing needs for food and help with navigating the immigration system. Hassan says many Afghan families who are in the U.S. legally still feel the impact of increased ICE presence. Though they shouldn't be detained or deported under the law, he says multiple people in Portland have been.
That situation caused chaos amongst the community members. Everybody was and still people are afraid that at any moment they can be arrested or apprehended for no reason.
Hassan says CEF was able to help detainees hire lawyers and some have been released, but others remain in custody. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Financial need is a top concern for Native students attending college, according to the American Indian College Fund. Now, Indigenous learners in Montana and across the U.S. can get help with those costs through College Fund scholarships. The group offers tuition money to tribal members and their descendants, with awards averaging $2,000 to $3,000. Tiffany Guspeth with the College Fund says the scholarships are focused on students attending tribal universities and colleges, or TCUs.
We support students at all academic levels, whether they are part-time, first-time entering, non-traditional students seeking various types of degree programs.
Montana has 7 TCUs, and there are 34 across the country. The application deadline is May 31st for awards that will be announced in July. Last year, the College Fund gave out $21 million in scholarships to more than 7,300 students. Guspeth says TCUs aren't just for Native students, and they offer an economical option to get a college degree. She says rural students in particular can benefit from TCUs.
The way TCUs are set up, they're really focused on a holistic student experience, making sure that students are welcomed, they have a sense of belonging on campus.
Guspeth says the average cost of attending a TCU in 2022 to 2023 was around $18,600, while a four-year public university costs more than $27,000. I'm Laura Hatch, Big Sky Connection.
Real food.
Real fun.
For real radio.
Made by real humans.
In your community.
It's the annual Radio Free Moscow Real Radio Dinner.
Supporting the work of KRFP 90.3 FM.
Keeping it real since 2004.
Featuring a thoughtfully sourced menu of local foods grown right here on the Palouse.
Purple Egyptian barley provided by Palouse Heritage.
Local squash from community gardeners.
Parsnips and chickpeas from Viola Gardens.
Locally brewed drinks by Hunga Dunga Brewing Company. Tickets get you a 3-course meal.
Starting with a salad of spring mix tossed with a lemon herb vinaigrette and garnished with local squash and roasted chickpeas and optional feta.
A main course of Palouse-grown purple Egyptian barley risotto with mushrooms and fennel, topped slow-roasted garlic.
And dessert serving ras malai, an Indian dessert consisting of sweetened, delicate cheese soaked in a cardamom and rose-infused milk.
Friday, April 3rd.
At the 1912 Center in Moscow!
Social hour and silent auction to begin at 6 p.m. Dinner at 7 p.m. Live auction at 8 p.m. at the 1912 Center.
You can get tickets online at www.krfp.org or available locally at Tie Dye Everything, Mikey's Heroes, and KRFP.
Family caregivers in Montana provide $2.8 billion of unpaid care a year, according to a new AARP report. The Valuing the Invaluable report lays out the economic impact of family caregiving. It shows the 150,000 Montanans caring for adult loved ones take on 132 million hours of care each year. Tim Summers, state director for AARP Montana, says this impacts everyone.
It's not if we're going to be caregivers, it's when and to what degree we're going to be caregivers. Without family caregivers, many more Montanans would rely on expensive institutional care.
Summers would like to see a state tax credit to help with the financial burden that can come with caring for a loved one. Nationally, the report says more than 59 million family caregivers provide more than $1 trillion of mostly unpaid labor, averaging 27 hours a week. Nancy Lamond, AARP Chief Engagement Officer, says caregiving's economic value tops federal, state, and local spending on Medicaid nationwide and almost doubles all out-of-pocket spending on health care. She adds this comes at a cost, with caregivers sometimes sacrificing their own health, jobs, and financial well-being.
This is not just a family issue. It's a labor force issue, an economic issue, and a health care system issue, and it demands action.
Congress is considering a $5,000 tax credit for family caregivers and legislation that would allow them to use health savings accounts for caregiving expenses. In Montana, Summers says caregivers could use more legislative support. He adds they don't often realize so many others are going through the same thing.
I think greater awareness and people knowing that they're not alone, that there is a lot of understanding, their neighbors, friends, even legislators have gone through this.
Summers emphasizes Montana has resources for caregivers through groups like the Area Agency on Aging and AARP. I'm Laura Hatch, Big Sky Connection.
The Boise No Kings rally Saturday attracted thousands, filling the grounds in front of the state capitol steps. The protest was not focused on any of the many violations of law and international norms by the Trump administration, but speakers spent a significant amount of time decrying the regional war Trump and Netanyahu started in the Middle East just a month before. The protest featured 26 booths set up by organizations and political candidates. I spoke with Idahoans for Women and Families Executive Director Melanie Falwell, whose group is collecting signatures for a citizens' initiative that would restore women's reproductive rights.
My name is Melanie Falwell. I'm Executive Director of Idahoans United for Women and Families. We're a statewide, nonpartisan, volunteer-driven citizens' ballot initiative to restore reproductive rights in Idaho. We are currently gathering signatures statewide at every corner of the state. We've gathered 87,000. We'd like to have 100,000 by the end of April, which is our deadline.
Right. And the end of April is the deadline, and there's a minimum you have to have, but it has to be from, what is it, 18 out of 35 counties, you have to have 6%, right?
We have to hit the threshold. It's 18 of the 35 legislative districts.
Legislative districts.
Yeah. So we are really pleased to probably have about 15 of the 18 qualified, and it would be our goal by the end of April to have 20.
Right, because that's what you need. Well, 18 is the minimum. So what are the counties you have the most potential to get over the line with? Legislative districts.
Yeah. So the legislative district y'all are in, which is six,
yes.
I'm so pleased that we've qualified. Still need signatures, still need to run up the score. But we up north, we would love to get legislative district one qualified. That's Sandpoint.
Yeah.
Love signatures from one. I'm very pleased that we've qualified District 4, Coeur d'Alene, but would love more signatures from there. And then way out east in Idaho, District 33 and 35, Idaho Falls, and then the district with Teton County. We're within a couple hundred, and we're going to tip those too.
Very good. Okay. And tell me what the initiative, how much reproductive rights would you get if this passes before the legislature goes and reverses it?
Sure. So what this piece of legislation would do is restore Idahoans to the standard we had for 50 years, that same level of access to legal, regulated abortion up to fetal viability and past that in cases of medical emergency, once again restoring people's ability to make decisions about their reproductive health with their doctors, not politicians. Right. Additionally, it would offer some protections for things like birth control, IVF, Plan B, things that are illegal right now but are also under attack. We're just going to make sure that everything related to a woman's reproductive health is a decision that can be made without a politician in the room.
Okay. And fetal viability, that's like a legal term that's been used in various abortion statutes around the nation, like even before Roe versus Wade got overturned. And Idaho has this heartbeat thing, and tell me what the difference is.
Yeah, so viability is a term about the ability of a fetus to survive outside the mother's body. Here in Idaho, we have a heartbeat bill, which is as soon as there is a heartbeat presence, very, very, very early in a pregnancy, abortion becomes illegal. So abortion is banned and illegal in Idaho.
Down to the zygote stage, really, right?
So one of the things that we have seen, one of the terrible consequences of that, is that sometimes a family will go in for a 20-week screening, wanted pregnancy, excited about the pregnancy, and they get some really terrible news. They discover that the fetus indeed has a heartbeat, but is missing some kind of critical system like a skull or a brain, or kidneys, and there is no chance of survival. It is a doomed pregnancy, but in Idaho, they can't get care at home with their trusted practitioner. They have to leave the state. They have to leave the kids they already have. Most people who need to access abortion are already mothers.
Right.
And it's just causing heartache, hardship, and it's driving obstetricians from our state.
Yeah, I've definitely heard about the reduction in pregnancy. People who deal with doctors who deal with problem pregnancies, especially, there's a special category of doctors, right?
Yeah, we're losing all the specialists that deal. They're called maternal fetal medicine specialists. We're losing them. We're losing family physicians, pediatricians, emergency docs, we are now dead last in the entire nation in all doctors per capita.
Oh, dear. Okay, and I just wanted to get back to the heartbeat thing, but Idaho law is actually, abortion is illegal now from the zygote or the plasticist stage. Is that correct?
It is. Additionally, the exceptions that we do have in Idaho are not worth the paper they're printed on, though we do have technically a rape and incest exception.
But?
Yeah, it has to be in the first trimester, and it requires that a police report be filed. And for a woman or a young girl who is experiencing sexual assault, that is often just not an option.
So your initiative would take care of that?
It would, yeah. It would. It would restore us back to how things were done in Idaho for nearly five decades, and the sky didn't fall.
Right. And what about these parental consent laws about health care that are going through the legislature? I assume you're initiative probably doesn't address that directly.
Right now Idaho has some of the most aggressive parental consent laws in the country. This initiative does not change that. You would still need to sign a permission slip for a minor to get something as simple as a Band-Aid. It is a law so aggressive that they are trying to fix it right now in the State House behind me.
But I thought you said progressive. You said aggressive.
Aggressive. Yeah, aggressive. Anybody that's got kids right now in school knows that they can't even get a Tylenol at school without, you know, a written permission slip. So that would not change under this law, but it would assure that people could get access to the care they need.
Right.
And minors would be able to get access with the permission of a parent or a guardian.
Okay, that's good to know. Let's see, anything else? I guess there is some legislation to quote-unquote fix the parental consent law going through, but it's pretty limited, right?
It's the problem with that law, it's had some devastating impacts on kids, for instance, needing to call a suicide hotline.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah.
They decided that that should be allowed, maybe.
Maybe, right? But under current Idaho law, a minor cannot access any health care, including mental health care, without permission from a guardian.
Yeah. There's a lot of problems for teens in Idaho. It seems like some of these legislators are just, you know, had it with teens and they just want to control them as much as possible. I guess it goes along with the, you know, the religious right takeover, you know.
Fair enough.
and I think you have a good chance of passing, too, but, like, the legislature can just reverse
it. They can, but here's the deal. We know that this initiative has 60% support from the people of Idaho.
Right.
And we've seen that in a lot of other very red states. They voted to expand reproductive rights while remaining a very red state. And I think it boils down to the fact that people do not want politicians calling the big, hard, difficult shots for them and their families. So, what we will do on the other side of that, that legislature very well may repeal the initiative. I will note they have only once in the history of ballot initiatives in Idaho repealed an initiative. It was term limits on themselves. But we will be there to meet that challenge and demand accountability from the people who voted for it.
Exactly. So even if they do it, then, well, there's a good chance you can get people out of it. And just having something like this on the ballot in 2026 seems to maybe bring out a little bit more of pushback to the Republican supermajority because people will be voting in the local elections too, right?
Yeah, our hope is to take the energy that, you know, there's a lot of folks mad at the government right now for a lot of different reasons, and we want to harness that energy to take back this privacy, this level of freedom, and reassert Idahoans' right to that.
That was Idahoans for Women and Families Executive Director Melanie Falwell speaking at Saturday's No Kings rally in Boise. Idahoans for Women and Families is collecting signatures for a ballot initiative that would go on the November ballot that would restore reproductive rights for women in Idaho. And that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, 20% chance of showers before midnight tonight, snow level 5,000 feet, cloudy during the evening, becoming partly cloudy overnight, low 36, 90% chance of showers tomorrow, snow level 4,800 feet, rising to 5,900 feet in the afternoon, high 50, up to a quarter inch of rain possible. Wednesday night, 100% chance of showers, snow level 5,900 feet, lowering to 3,200 feet after midnight, low 34, east winds 5 to 10, becoming west in the evening, gusting up to 20, between a quarter and a half inch of rain possible. On Thursday, 80% chance of precipitation, snow showers likely before noon, then rain and snow showers, then rain showers after 2. Snow level rising to 3,200 feet in the afternoon, high 44, west winds 15, gusts up to 30. Little or no snow accumulation expected. Thursday night, 30% chance of showers before midnight, snow level 3,600 feet, mostly cloudy, low 32, west winds 5 to 15, gusts up to 25. Mostly clear Friday through Saturday, highs 52 Friday and 60 on Saturday, with a low of 34 Friday night. Partly cloudy Saturday night and Sunday, low 39, high 64. Currently 45. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business or nonprofit supports community radio. You can adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button as well. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. And don't forget, tickets for the Real Radio Dinner are available on the KRFP.org website. Also downtown at Mikey's Heroes and Tie-Dye Everything. and available at the station, 114 East 3rd Street. Thanks for listening. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a good night.
Programming on KRFP is made possible in part by support from KRFP members and
John's Alley Tavern, Moscow's home of live music. John's Alley is located at 114 East 6th Street in downtown Moscow.
Programming on KRFP is also sponsored by Friends of the Clearwater, a 501c3 environmental nonprofit dedicated to protecting your public lands. FOC is defending the wildlands, wildlife, and waterways of north central Idaho for future generations. Friendsoftheclearwater.org.
KRFP, Moscow is the best in the USA.
Yeah.